you know, if you walk out into your lobby and somebody throws a football and it hits you, you didn't see it coming, your body kind of like half curls up, right? Your hands go and protect your head. Your body kind of curls over, kind of like a fetal position. It's to protect you. Well, we didn't come up with that. The body just did that. Well, I think there's a mental fetal position where you've been beat up so much, whether it's age 3 or 5 or 10 or 15 or 20 or yesterday, you've been beat up so much that when things go wrong, you curl up in that fetal position again. And that is the brain. That's not you being weak. That's not you needing to make a couple changes in your life. That's not you needing to get out and run. That is got to be taken care of, because that's what you snap back to, is that helpless, hopeless, not good enough.
Hey guys, don't forget to check out the Street Cop Training Conference, April 23rd through the 28th, 2023 at the Gaylord Opryland Resort and Convention Center. It's going to be a great experience. 5 career-changing days, some of the most profound speakers in the industry. Guest speakers include Rob O'Neill, the guy who killed Bin Laden, Kyle Carpenter, the youngest living Congressional Medal of Honor winner, Fox News host Tommy Lahren, Navy SEAL American war hero Jason Redman, Sheriff David Clark, Sheriff Mark Lamb, and Sheriff Wayne Ivey. You'll also spend time with all of our Street Cop instructors at this event Monday through Friday. We'll have a great lineup of courses in addition to our great speakers. It will be a week that you will not forget. You'll be thankful you came. You don't want to miss out. Check out StreetCop.com on how to register. If you're going to use the room code, make sure you book it from Sunday through Friday. That's what the code's good for, and it's about half the price of the regular rate. But those rooms are running out, so make sure you sign up now. We'll see you there. Hey guys, welcome to this episode of the Street Cop Training Podcast. We host founder and CEO of Street Cop Training. My name is Dennis Bonino, and we have today with us, returning back for his second time, none other than the angry Viking therapist, Dr. Trevor Wilkins. And before we go on, dude, thanks for being here again, but give everybody the 90-second synopsis of who you are and how you ended up becoming a psychotherapist.
Yeah, so I spent 15 years in uniform law enforcement, mostly with a state agency, did some EMS and fire before that, some dispatcher before that. Had an incident that put me in a really bad place. A critical incident would probably be, you know, in top 5 of things that people have to see. And although it didn't turn off my career right then, over the next couple of years, I rapidly started to decline. Reached out for help, couldn't get any help, eventually was let go from law enforcement because of my anger and I wasn't healing. Went to a couple people that honestly told me that they didn't know how to fix me and they didn't know where to send me. And so that led me into needing a new career, but first going to school to try to figure out what was wrong with me. That was my sole goal of going to college for 10 years, ending up with a doctorate in counseling, and turned into a pretty cool job. Now I get to help public safety members, adults with childhood trauma across the nation. So from cop to therapist, in the absolute hardest way possible, but the absolute most fulfilling way possible.
What was that profound moment that you said, I'm going to be a therapist? This is it.
It was after I had started actually going to school to be a therapist. I truly went to kind of fix myself. I finished my bachelor's. My last couple of years of law enforcement is a thing that had been hanging over my head for years. I have some daughters. I wanted to be able to say that I finished. They've been hanging over my head. So honestly, I'm in a really bad place. I just finished my degree. I never want to go to college again. I've just lost my job. And I'm looking at my school's website and see they have a master's in counseling. And I thought, maybe that will help me. Maybe I can take these couple of years and figure out what's wrong with me, fix my family that was falling apart, fix my career that I had lost. Finish that. That can get you licensed as a professional counselor. Swore I'd never go to college again. Once again, one night sitting at home in kind of a tough space trying to figure out life, and figured out there was a doctorate for what I was doing, and honestly did not think that I would get in. I'm not an academic. I don't call myself educated, despite the formal education. I know I've got that title, but I'm not a college guy. I definitely did not fit in that world, but I decided to give it a shot. I got in, ended up doing a dissertation specifically about public safety, mental health, and the stress that we deal with, the ongoing chronic stress, and how that changes things, and decided that if there was a profound moment, it was around then that I decided every time that I talked to somebody that had been in my position, and it turned out there was a lot, because I felt very alone at first, turned out there was a lot, they got something from it and said thanks. And that turned into kind of the fulfilling way to deal with the lack of law enforcement fulfillment that I had. So if there may not have been a moment, it was that series of events. And, you know, much like many things in life, things just kind of get on that train and start rolling. My wife and I have this saying. I had a buddy that I knew in North Carolina, is kind of a famous Green Beret on Instagram, and former Green Beret. He's got kind of a big following. And he and his staff called me, or sent me a message one day and called me and pretty much asked if I'd come down and talk to them, and then would I be on their podcast. So this was kind of the first, like, outside the box, outside of sitting in a therapist office chair that I was doing. And so I called my wife first and told her about this. And she said, man, our life is weird. You know, you were just supposed to be a captain by 45, ride off into the sunset in retirement one day. And that was our plan, to be a retired cop one day and her retired nurse one day, and we could travel and raise our kids. And now our life is weird, because now I'm on podcasts and I'm meeting people in other, you know, states and other countries and making friends with them, and that are all driven to help cops, to help public safety members, to help. And so it's this weird series of events. I have a private practice in Kentucky and an online program for people that aren't in Kentucky. And if you'd have told me I had that 10 years ago, I'd have laughed at you. It's just a series of events that got us, that I just keep going. You know, you and I talked before. The one thing that nobody can control is how hard I work. And so I just keep working, and it just keeps happening.
Has it helped you with you doing this work?
Wholeheartedly. And really in two ways. One was some of that education. Unfortunately, and cops and fire and EMS will understand this, military too, all those years of education, I definitely learned things. But much like our academies, the day I got out, I knew nothing. You know, I had some base knowledge of what to do, but I didn't have this. This is a great example for your program. I didn't have the case law yet. I didn't have the how-tos. I had the statutes in the academy. I had how to talk to people to an extent. I knew how to pay attention to detail and some things about investigations, how to drive, how to shoot. I knew anything about being the police, and none of us do. We all have to learn that. It takes things like ongoing training, like you guys. But yeah, I go back to the case law thing. God, I wish I knew more case law when I was in law enforcement. Well, the same thing kind of happens in mental health. You graduate with these letters behind your name. I'm proud of them. I worked hard for them. But I remember sitting in front of my first client thinking, so what do you want to talk about? Because I don't know what to talk about. And hope they'd say something like they hate their mom, or, you know, something I could latch onto. It was the case law and the continuing to get better at my career and the continuing to be a lifetime learner that made me better at it, made me help other people. So one, it was that that education did help, whether it be the initial education or kind of the follow-up and what I continue to learn today. It teaches me and sometimes makes me go, oh yeah, I need to change this too, not just the people I'm talking to. But the other part that helped me, I think, was seeing other people get better, not because of me, but hopefully with some help from me. So I love it. One of my favorite things is I get to go all over the place and talk about public safety and mental health and PTSD and trauma and how it affects us. That's something that's been really cool about my life lately. And somebody inevitably always comes up at the end and says, man, it's like you were talking about me. And I always tell them, that's easy. I was talking about me. So their healing, their light bulbs going off, they're getting better. They're understanding that somebody out there gets it, that they're not alone in this battle. That probably helps me now as much as kind of the formal education did. I'm a totally different person than 15 years ago. If you'd have told me today, 15 years ago, I'd be a doctor with a private practice in mental health, I'd have told you were an idiot, because I wouldn't have even gone to a therapist 15 years ago. So I think it's helped me in a non-traditional way, my help is probably a little more traditional, being in the office, the online program, the talking to people through Zoom, the going out and speaking to people, the helping with legislation and education and advocacy. But it probably helped me in a little different way, but it definitely has.
Do you ever get like angry with issues or clients' frustration? And I'll tell you why I asked that. It's clear I am not hiding the fact that I actually go to therapy. And I want to also say that, like, I'm not ashamed to say that, because I don't go to therapy to like be talked off the outer bridge. Mm-hmm. That's not what I'm there for. I'm there so I can support other people in my life and be the best human being I can possibly be. So try to understand essentially other people in my life and maybe what they're going through and just have a lot more compassion. I'm very thankful for that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because it takes a lot of work to get compassionate. It does take work. And it's probably tied into this. You've got to really put thought, time, energy, and effort into it. Matter of fact, this past weekend, I was in a conversation with somebody and they said, well, this person drank in excess. And I said, well, that person often does. And they said, well, but you know, it's like, you know, shouldn't be doing that. I go, agreed. But we don't know why that person is doing that. Mm-hmm. So, and they said, well, if I was this and I'm not doing that, why should that person do? I go, well, what your brain reacts to your circumstances versus what that person's brain reacts to their circumstances are two very different things. And you're not a young guy. So here's a lesson learned. I bet you if so-and-so came down and told us some crazy cockamamie insane shit from his life, you would just essentially see it differently. Now, I see a book behind you I'm familiar with called the Seven Habits of Highly Effective People. Is that right under the 10X rule?
Yep.
I implore everybody, and I've read it on the podcast, to read The Paradigm Shift in the Subway. It's really important to see. But having compassion doesn't make you soft. It makes you understand. It actually calms you down quite a bit about most situations. Mm-hmm. And look, there's still things that I'm frustrated with in my life of like, how come that? This person's not getting that. Why? You know, and again, personal issues. So how do you find one compassion for that, patience? How did you learn to find compassion and patience for that as well? And do you still get frustrated but try to keep it to yourself?
So I certainly do, but because of where I'm at in life in the mental health world, it definitely doesn't affect me the same way as I would compare to like getting frustrated with people when I was in law enforcement. You know, getting frustrated with people on the side of the road. Now I'm fully aware that side of the road is a bit more life and death at times, because I've been there and I can say that, opposed to my office or sitting on Zoom or talking to people in the moment. But outside of that moment, it's still pretty life or death. And one of the things you said about, you know, that you've processed it through the week, I always tell people, I want people to get something out of the 30 minutes or hour that they're with me. But I truly believe your best therapy is that drive home when the brain's going, oh, that part makes sense. Yep, that's what I do right there. This part makes sense. So I like that week of people that are willing to take it, digest it, try to apply it, and come back. And a lot of that is cops, right? That's what we do. If you, I tell a story long ago. So some of my years, I was in commercial vehicle enforcement, working with the big trucks, and I didn't know anything about commercial vehicles, nothing. I knew they had 18 wheels. But it was a new challenge. It was something different to do. It was a new unit to try out. And I remember like stopping my first one and like, hey, I need to see your logbook. And he's like, oh, if you're under 500 air miles, you don't have to have a logbook. I'm like, oh, yeah, that makes sense. Okay, yeah, sure. 500 is not very long. And I just finished what I was doing, went on about my way. And I go home and I read the federal statutes that night. And I'm like, man, that SOB got one over on me. You know, like that's not even remotely true. So the next guy I got out with that tried something like that, it didn't go so well, right? So the I think that's what cops do. I think we continuously learn, or the good ones continuously learn, keep ourselves safe, how to be more effective, how to talk to people differently, how to deal with the system, how to deal with ourselves, how to deal with our mental health. So the ones that I see excel really well are the ones that are willing to kind of do that work, like she said about you. But yeah, there are absolutely times where, maybe I'll see somebody weekly or every other week and nothing's changing because they're not doing anything. And I actually had a discussion about this earlier today with somebody. I love the Goggins and the Jockos and the Brian Roses and you know, the guys that are, hey man, you're letting yourself down. You need to get off the couch and do this. And you know that an hour that you just spent doing nothing, you could have done this or gotten yourself more physically fit, or, and that's all very important. And there's the first point of that people do need to do that. If we're being honest with ourselves, we're not all of us are trying hard enough and keeping our character and keeping what we said we would be. To me, character's what you told other people you would be. So if you're blowing character every day, you're beating yourself up too. So if you're just continuously blowing character, whether that's something that you should be doing, whether that's something you shouldn't be doing, that's when you just still drive home with the same mentality after therapy or after trying to get better, because you've blown it again, as opposed to that constant drive. So yes, there are definitely people that work really hard at getting better. There are definitely people that don't work very hard at it and kind of stay in the same place. Now I'll add one group to that I'm cognizant of, and I try to be careful with, because again, this is where I was going with the, you know, the Jockos and the Goggins and the, like, I love that stuff. But there is a group that when that's all that they've learned to make themselves better in mental health, they'll start degrading themselves too far in the end. And, you know, we've talked, I'm not the therapist that says, oh man, you're okay, and look what you've done in your life, and it's all going to be okay, and it's all positive, and just quit talking to yourself badly. No, I want to get some work done with you. We got to change your mentality. But if you're in this place of life where that derogatory talk is doing nothing but pushing you down further, we need to do a little more examination. And those aren't the people that I necessarily get so frustrated with. And what that leads into is the understanding that with that group, today's dysfunctional emotions, or anger, anxiety, depression, and guilt, are created by earlier life events that left us feeling helpless, hopeless, and not good enough. Now, those aren't terms that we as cops like to use. I would barely, if ever, say I was helpless, hopeless, or not good enough. But if we have previous life events, age 2, 5, 10, 12, 15, or yesterday, that left us feeling helpless, hopeless, not good enough, and we're stuck in this emergency mode, what I call the mental health fetal position, then that derogatory self-talk or that just taking steps to get better may not be enough. That's where real mental health help comes in. That's where the big trauma professionals, those of us that specialize in trauma, really come in, because we've got to get that mentality out of it. And the reason I call it the mental health fetal position, to kind of finish answering that question, is, you know, if you walk out into your lobby and somebody throws a football and it hits you, you didn't see it coming, your body kind of like half curls up, right? Your hands go and protect your head, your body kind of curls over, kind of like a fetal position. It's to protect you. Well, we didn't come up with that. The body just did that. Well, I think there's a mental fetal position where you've been beat up so much, whether it's age 3 or 5 or 10 or 15 or 20 or yesterday, you've been beat up so much that when things go wrong, you curl up in that fetal position again. And that is the brain. That's not you being weak. That's not you needing to make a couple changes in your life. That's not you needing to get out and run. That is got to be taken care of, because that's what you snap back to, is that helpless, hopeless, not good enough. And I always thought in law enforcement or working with cops and public safety and military type A individuals nobody would agree with that, helpless, hopeless, not good enough. But what I found is those that are stuck there and that have that as their mental health reaction, they all go, yep, 100%, that's what I do. Small doses, maybe I don't feel like a piece of crap all the time, but in small doses, yep, you hit the head of the nail. That's it right there. And a lot of that, if you think of it in the terms of adults with childhood trauma, I would work with a lot of adults with trauma, and I'd get adults with childhood trauma, and we'd do well, but I just couldn't get them to like turn the corner. You know, life wasn't getting better. And it wasn't until I figured out the thing about early trauma, the difference is it leaves people with this umbrella of guilt and shame. And until we get through that guilt and shame, we're not dealing with the traumas. We're not dealing with the daily functioning. Getting up and running is not going to do it. Just bettering yourself and making yourself to the gym and thinking more positive things and more rational things is not going to do it. We got to deal with that guilt and shame. And if that's what people have, that's the umbrella, and that's what we got to fix. So I do get frustrated with people, probably not very openly. Like you kind of alluded to, I probably keep it to myself, just turn the corner a little bit on how we're dealing with things. But sure, I absolutely can get frustrated at times. I definitely still lose my temper in public once in a while. It's still the angry Viking therapist, not the completely in remission angry Viking therapist, you know. But so I'm still working on that. That's my thing. But yeah, I mean, absolutely, I do get frustrated. It would never cause me to quit on somebody, but maybe we need to turn the corner a little bit. Is it guilt and shame? Is it helpless, hopeless, not good enough? Or are we just mad about this thing? So yes and no, I guess, is the long answer.
You had a dissertation that you talked about earlier when you finished your doctorate. What are some solutions that you came up with in your dissertation on your early stage analysis, and has that changed at all?
It's a good question. So I want to tell you about the dissertation, but because it came up with some pretty crazy numbers that I think will surprise people, not in how it happened, but surprise people in the amount. But the solution side was not necessarily do this, do this, do this, do this, and it'll be better, right? I think we have a lot of that in life. A lot of people selling the five-step process to making things better. And sometimes that's okay. But I don't think that's always the solution. It's not a one-size-fits-all, especially when you're dealing with the public and people. So the dissertation, in effect, the reason that I did it was I was getting to that point where I needed to start studying something. Part of a PhD and the dissertation is that you're contributing to your specialty. You're contributing new research, individual research at a high level to your specialty. So I'd read a statistic that the average years of service for suicide of a law enforcement officer was 20 years. And that blew me away. I was thinking 5 or 6, maybe 10, you know, the middle of that divorce, the kids don't like me, I'm not making enough money, I'm really stressed out at work, I can't get the assignment I want. That's when I was thinking it would be high. No, it's at 20. And I know each state's a little different, and I know it's even a little harder now than when we started. But 20 was the end for us. Like, we were all looking for 2025. That was the goal. So here we are with a group of individuals who are getting to the end, or at least the light at the end of the tunnel. And that on average is who's committing suicide. And remember, that's average. So there's people even higher than that, that have gone further than that in law enforcement doing it. And that didn't make sense to me. So I thought, what is going on in a 20, 25 year law enforcement career that is causing it to be so much worse at the end? Well, trauma is extremely important, but trauma has been studied a lot. Trauma is a big, important thing of mine, but I didn't want to start there because trauma itself almost solved the equation for me in my head. Oh, we see some really bad things. Civilians see 1.5 to 2 critical events in their life. Law enforcement officers will see between 750 and 800. So trauma made sense. So I didn't want to go down that road just yet. It became important to me, but I didn't want to go there. So what is going on stress-wise in a 20-25 year career? So what I did was took hundreds and hundreds of officers throughout the state of Kentucky, where I'm located, agencies from one man departments to the largest in the city, in the state, every demographic, demographic of location, every region, and every years of service. I had from 1 year of service to one gentleman had 41 years of service. Most were in the 15s, 10s to 15s, the average. And I gave them 2 questionnaires. And the first one had to do with operational stress. And operational stress is the job, the handcuffing, the late nights, the you lose your friends, the you don't eat well, you got to fight people, you got to go to court. It's the stuff, it's the job that people think about. That was operational stress. And organizational stress was not necessarily admin. It was the organization of policing as a whole today. And it did include some admin. I don't feel backed up by my agency. We don't have the training we need. We don't have the equipment we need. We don't have the pay we need. I have substandard equipment. If I get to a use of force or a critical situation, I don't feel my agency will back me. So there was questions about that too. And what I found, not to get too technical in numbers, but the average, the mean, was about in the middle. On a 0 to 120 point scale, 0 being none of it bothered you, 120 was where it topped out at mathematically. It was in the 50s and 60s, both operational, organizational. That makes sense. Some people had less, some people had more. Yeah, that makes sense. But that didn't tell me about the 25-year career. So I did this thing. It's called the canonical correlation. It's this huge statistic, a research statistic that you can do. And it looks at everything together instead of just comparing one thing to another. And it looks at everything. It looks at everything mathematically over 25 years was the parameter. And what I found in one of those two sides completely blew me away. On the operational side, I kind of felt like the stress would go down. You know, I was a 15-year cop. At year 15, I wasn't thinking about the handcuffing and the night shifts and the eating poorly and the driving fast. It was just the job. So keep in mind that 0 to 120 point scale, with 120 being the highest. What I found was over a 25 career, the average of operational stress went down about 25, 27 points. Yep, makes sense to me. And I also kind of figured that organizational stress would go up. Remember the equipment and the pay and the lack of training and I don't feel backed by my administration. I don't feel protected in this job anymore. That 0 to 120 point scale, again, started in the middle. Some had more, some had less. And I felt like, I hypothesized that it would probably go up, whether we recognized it more, whether it became a bigger problem. What I didn't realize was how much it would go up. So on a 0 to 120 point possible scale, over a 25-year career, organizational stress went up 67 points. 67 points. Here's what that tells me. I don't know all the things that go on in those officers' mind. I don't know where they are when that suicide happens or when the burnout happens specifically. But I can tell you this. According to that, it's not the job that's killing us. It's not the handcuffing and the driving fast and the people yelling at us, all that stuff that we focus on and we should focus on. But that's not what's killing us. The organization is killing us. The organization is what's eating our people alive. And if you're a supervisor or a leader, that should really say something to you. Now, I don't know 100% what the fix is for that, but that was a huge slap in the face when I got those numbers back. It's the organization, not the operation.
It's interesting that you bring that up because there's been complaints or reported back to me, complaints with some of our memes that we put on our Instagram page. You know, and look, they are done with purpose and intent to address sure. The real issues in law enforcement. You're smiling. I'm reading your body language, right? See, I'm reversing right, shit right. On you, dude. I know what therapists do. But, you know, with that being said, it's comical that we make these memes and these administrations use it as a way to say, well, this is why we can't have you going to a place like this. Look what these guys do to administrators. And the response back should be, they do it to fucked up administrators, not not good ones, right? And guess what? The bad ones, I want them to hear me. I want them to see it and have a click in their brain of, oh, shit, that's us, right? Maybe things are bad here. Trevor, every day of my life, I daydream about having some of the worst administrators in this profession sitting down at a roundtable discussion with me, just me, and going over why they behave the way that they do. I know somebody right now who was disagreeing with their boss, who wasn't their boss, but at the same agency. Now that person works under that boss. And the first thing they do day one is punitive damage for disagreeing when the boss is wrong about a piece of case law. Just damage. Now you're getting fucked with because you didn't bow down and just submit that you were wrong when the person was completely correct because right. The person above them doesn't have the humility to say, you're right, I was wrong. No, now that I'm your boss, now I'm going to fuck with you. It's horrible, dude. And what I'm saying to everybody is I don't like bullies. Most cops don't. And why the fuck are you bullying each other or bullying people in your organization? I just don't get it, right? Not you're a real fuck. Yeah, you're a real sweetheart in fucking public, right? Yeah. But inside the four walls, like why do you treat your people the worst? You know, why do we do that to our people? And it's, how do they not acknowledge any responsibility? It really makes me nuts. And that's a lot of my motivation behind the things that I say and do. You know, it's
I think we talked about this earlier before we recorded. You know, I think one of the major problems in law enforcement, if not the major problem, is administrators that are not willing to let the public be uncomfortable. Now, I understand I've never been a chief, not going to pretend I've ever been one. I'm a business owner, so I got to play some of that, you know, two side public versus in-house, but I've never been a chief. But, you know, chiefs or sheriffs or colonels or whatever that are unwilling to say, folks, I know you don't like it. This is the way we need to do it. This is the why we did it. And this is what you hired us to do. And sometimes it's going to be uncomfortable. We're not talking about immoral and ethical things or, you know, unprofessional things, but man, you know, how many cops I talk to every day that just feel so let down by their administration. And I think part of it is we set it up ourselves a little bit to fail. One, like you said, you're not promoted on leadership in most places, small agency, maybe, you know, where they can kind of pick and know who you are. But most agencies, you know, that I've talked to, you can test to a certain rank, lieutenant or captain, kind of, you know, lower administrative rank. And then everything after that, a lot is appointed. And I realize there's some good behind that. But, you know, a lot of agencies leave you at that administrative pay, lieutenant or captain or whatever you've amassed. And then they add like 30,000 a year for the next rank, major, and they add 30,000 a year for like assistant chiefs. Now, there's a lot of good majors and assistant chief, you know, high level administration out there. But at any moment, they could be kicked back to lieutenant or captain. And now there's a lot of lieutenants and or a lot of maybe majors and assistant chiefs, lieutenant colonels or wherever they're at, that are willing to say, keep your stupid money, I'll go back. I'm going to stand up for the right thing. But they're pretty few and far between. And so you're kind of on permanent probation when you're at that level. You know, tomorrow I could send you back to captain and you lose $60,000 a year. Now, none of us did it for the money. But I remember my first, what I made the first year of policing. And it was at least half of $60,000, if not even lower. So by the time you have a spouse and three kids and a boat and a vacation home or whatever, a camper, you can't afford to lose $60,000. So you sit on your hands a little bit more. And I said that there's some good things to being able to appoint people too, because it gets rid of some of that argument of testing, but $60,000 is a lot of money to lose just because I was willing to stand up for this officer that I think did right. You know, maybe one of those officers, I remember a specific scenario early in my career where a sergeant said, hey, I love your heart. Don't do that anymore. You know, like he knew why I did what I did, nothing illegal or immoral. He knew I being aggressive. And he said, love your heart. Don't do that anymore. And I was livid for weeks. It took me a while to realize there's a bigger picture here. I get it. There's a little bit bigger picture here. I was wrong. So we set ourselves up for failure. That's one way. There's probably plenty others. But then clearly, I'm a quantitative guy. I like numbers. I like evidence. I like case law. I like examples. I like seeing people do what they say they do and how it worked out. You know, one of my favorite things about teaching public safety, about mental health, is the reason I did the dissertation is because we're all evidence-based people. You know, none of us want to go to court and say, I think that guy did it. All right. We're all going to court saying, I saw him do it. The evidence says he did it. He's on camera. I've eliminated all other suspects. Right. I'm not going to court with maybe. But man, we make some maybe decisions out there in the public safety employment realm. And I wanted to be able to say when I go talk to people, hey, here's how I know we have a problem. You know we have a problem. I know we have a problem because I've been in it. Let me show you the numbers of why we've had a problem. But there's so many decisions made out there now at that level without that. You know, whether it's because of that chronic stress, maybe added with trauma, I'm sure is pieces of it, but that's what's going on. You know, I wanted evidence. I wanted to be able to say, actually, sir, 67 points higher is how much, you know, for this large group of people.
You know, how do we get people to acknowledge that? This is the rub here, right? To acknowledge that you're contributing to high rates of suicide. Do you even care? Why don't you? Like, where does that come from? Why don't you care? I was thinking about that on the way in, right? I was thinking about some of the things that have been said to me when I put my heart, soul, and everything into it. They knew I was the guy that cared about it more than anybody.
and to literally, you know, I don't just say the things that were said to me at times. It was just purely heartbreaking. So I, a TikTok, there's that, heavyset black dude who's like a gospel speaker. Have you seen a lot of his TikToks coming out? He's really good. He's really good. I don't know who he is. I gotta look into it more. Real good dude, real good speaker. And he talked about, take somebody who's got an artistic mind. It doesn't matter where you put them, they're going to find their way out. Mm-hmm. You can only control somebody who has that kind of brain, that kind of desire for so long. And he said something like, you put them in a pit, they'll crawl out. You put them in a cage, they'll find the key. You know, and there's a complete deficit in this profession on so many levels. And the only suggestion or the only solution that I see is, one, there could be a little bit of convincing to the old guard, but not much. What I'm trying to do is use the attention here to speak to the souls of the future leaders and look on it 10, 15 years from now and say, we actually had some impact. We actually changed some stuff. These guys and girls recognize as they progress through the ranks what was important. May not have been easy, right? Not easy to do the right thing. It's not easy to stand up for people. It takes courage. Believe me, this kind of shit takes courage. But you got to get peaceful with your courage. You got to get real calm with it. You got to get comfortable with the what if the courage doesn't work and sometimes won't. You know, you have to think ahead in life. What's your reputation going to be? Can't understand the mindset of somebody who is comfortable with having a bad reputation. Like consciously knows that they're a well-known piece of shit. I don't know if I one day, maybe a profound visit from the Lord who will explain to me how that happens. How does somebody comfortable with being a scumbag? I just don't understand that at all. And I don't mean that in a sense of like, we get it. Society has fucked up people. I'm talking about somebody who puts a uniform on, takes an oath, is a law enforcement officer, and then internally is just a straight up piece of shit. How is that possible? You're supposed to be the leading example for society on who we are supposed to be as human beings. When cops are literally who we are supposed to be as human beings. They're the best humans I've ever met in my life. And you know, it's so comforting and such a relief to see so many great supervisors out there at times. You know, we know them, we're friends with them, and we're thankful, but there's not many of them. I hate to admit that it's not a split 50-50. No. It's probably more of an 80-20, to be honest with you. And I might be giving a little leniency on that as well, but we can change that. Like, I know we can. And I've made these suggestions. At the academy level, I think you all should be watching leadership videos. We had to watch videos when I was in my third academy during the lunch breaks. And, oh, it was so stupid. So whatever. Just so it was like, one was National Geographic and seeing different perspectives of a butterfly. Oh. Like weird shit like that, right? But like, we're in the YouTube era now. I could literally, if you gave me an hour, find 50 videos that should be played at the recruit level every day at lunch. Or, you know, there's times when like, all right, we got an elective 2 hours. We can't go anywhere. What do you want to do? Bro, hop on some leadership shit, right? Go into some financial education. That stuff matters. That's all mental stuff, man. That comes back later on. You know what I mean? Play the Street Cop Training podcast, right? Like, or like, that's why we have that stuff out there. We're not trying to hide this stuff from anybody, but Trevor, we're never going to get to another topic. We're never going to get to dating relationships. We'll have to wait for the next time.
Well, even when you said before we started, you know, what can we talk about? And we had some good ideas. And, you know, sometimes that trauma and stress gets not overdone, but we're doing better about talking about it now. So it can be a little in people's face. And, but it always comes back to it. You know, it always comes back to the real problems. You know, how does an officer willing to put on a uniform be okay with that shitty reputation? There's a couple mental health things come to mind, but the biggest one is this chronic beatdown, you know, over a 20-year career. Now, there are some people that maybe should have gotten in the profession in the first place, you know, whether that's because of a past stuff they're dealing with, whether that's because they got in it for the wrong reasons, you know, just off the cuff. But that chronic beatdown, too, is a really easy way to go from really good cop to worst employee ever. You know, trauma is another one of those. And again, none of these, and I know you think this way, none of these are allowed to be excuses. You still got to change it. But where does it possibly come from? One is just the way people are sometimes, and they manage to get in a uniform. And some of it is that chronic, you know, that's when I go and speak, that's how I describe kind of my journey of those last about 5 years of law enforcement. I went from, you know, a guy with multiple awards for bravery in the line of duty to the absolute worst employee you could ever work for. I was horrible. I was getting written up all the time. I ended up in all the way from the lieutenants to the major's office, you know, all the time. And I made fun of those guys who were turds. But I just, well, here's another way. People ask me all the time, like, hey, what fond memories do you have of law enforcement? Like, what do you think about over your career? And I think, man, here's the kind of sad part. What I remember the most when I think of law enforcement is the last 4 years sitting in the median, pissed off at the world. That's what I remember a cop was my last 4 years. I was pissed off at everybody. Everybody was against me. I was angry at everything. And I went from that guy who made fun of people sitting in the median to being the guy sitting in the median. And I'm a type A guy. I like to work. You know, I'm a 100-hour a week guy. You're a business owner. You know, we work all the time. I saw a great video the other day. It said, I was tired of working 9 to 5. So I started a business. Now I work 24/7. I'm like, oh, I feel that. I work all the time, but, and that's okay. I'm willing to, but I went from the 100-hour a week guy to sitting in the meeting pissed off. Maybe not a turd, you know, I'd still take my calls and do what needed to be done. But it was the chronicness of the beatdown over the years. And I was pre-2020. You know, like that's even more of a beatdown. Not an excuse still. We still got to do what we said we do. But gosh, that chronic beatdown can really get on top of you.
You know, it's interesting that you talk about this. And this is why I encourage people to seek greener pastures. And then you'll see our Instagram stories. I know you follow us. And you'll see that I post the messages back from those memes that say, like, hey, come on over and we'll appreciate you. Leave the shitty place. Yeah. Over and over again. The reason I say that is because it's true. And I know it's true, not because I'm just guessing, because the feedback we receive over and over again and in person all the time, probably more than anything, is, hey, man, I was fucking miserable, right? Mm-hmm. And I was scared to leave, but I left, and it's the best thing that ever happened to me. My marriage improved. My health's improved. They treat me like a human being. Things are great. I have such a great career ahead. I'm really enjoying my life. Folks, you can't hang your hat of misery or happiness on a variable of $2 or $3 an hour. You just can't. You got to follow that fear. You have to dig deep and say, am I willing to stay here at this place and continue to suffer? Or can I suffer just momentarily to not suffer anymore? Mm-hmm. It's like no more than anything different than chronic illness and maybe a surgery that'll fix it. Oh, the surgery is going to suck for 2 or 3 weeks. You know, you're going to really have some heavy recovery, but we think overall you're going to feel a lot better. Mm. Right. And people are like, I'll just sit here and be in fucking chronic pain. For me, you know, I get why that is. What I'm saying to people who are listening to this is, I don't care what profession you're in. We know there are non-cops listening to this. Why would you stay if you're valuable enough to be appreciated by somebody else?
Yeah.
And appreciate yourself, man. Right? Like, stop telling yourself this fucking story. I've heard it all. Oh, I'm not going to that place. They don't have outer vest carriers. Yeah, they have a better schedule. They're like, they treat their people better. They have better equipment. So what? Right? Like, I'm not going to that place. In 7 years, I got a real shot at getting a canine here. Yeah, but you guys get suspended all the time. They're fucking destroying you guys, right? Like, you got to come to this happy medium of, is it worth it? Is it not? It's no different than any relationship in your life. I'm dating this person. Is it worth it? Is it not? And those who can make the decisions to move on to better relationships will have better things in the end. They just can't take the hurt now, but the hurt later is so much more worse, dude. It is no fucking joke. You will pay later.
Yeah. And it's, you know, never be afraid to leave for the right reason. I do always, you know, tell people, and I'm sure this is part of the rhetoric with you guys, you know, make sure you're in the right place first. You know, don't go for silly reasons.
Right.
Like you said, like vest carriers. And it's, a lot of people don't care about the same things. The University of Kentucky here years ago, a good friend of mine who's a professor here, they did a mental health study with one of the local PD, one of the largest local PDs. And I think it was a questionnaire of stress and stuff like that. And the last question was open-ended. What would make your job better? What would make your career better? And my buddy, who's this therapist and psychologist or professor, rather, he calls me. He knows nothing about law enforcement. Very invested in it, just has never been there. And he said, "Hey, man, what the heck are outer vest carriers?" You know, like that's what everybody wrote on the what would make your career better, which I get. I never got to wear one. They seem pretty cool. Maybe my back wouldn't be so jacked up. I don't know. I don't know how that works. But we're in that little sliver of we got to have this. And the rest of the public's like, "What are you talking about? What are you talking about? We have no idea that you're even upset about this," you know? And I don't know that they necessarily have to know. We need to know the police stuff, not necessarily them. But that was an interesting moment for me of him like, "Hey, what the hell is an outer vest carrier?" You know, like that here is your open-ended question about making your mental health and law enforcement better. And that's what we came up with as a whole, you know? And again,
but it goes to show you what makes people happy. Sometimes it's small things, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And maybe that physical thing will help people physically, will help them mentally, but if we leave solely for that, is it really going to change in the place that we go to? You know, you got to be in a, whatever a good place is when you go, whether that's mental or physical, you know, make sure you're not the problem. And then maybe it's time to find somewhere else to be appreciated.
I think that if people don't know they're the problem. They're never going to change because they're the problem. They don't understand that they're the problem. And I know people like that as well. It's interesting as you talk about these vests, and I'm going to wrap with this. I think about, we had a post in the group recently in our Facebook group and I think I put something up where it's like, you know, why doesn't everybody have a canine? But think about this at its core of what a canine unit does. Mm. You ever meet people who are from a police department that has canine units and how proud they are of their canine units? Mm-hmm. Literally, people just love to brag about having a dog or two dogs, have four dogs, forget it. Like, "Oh no, we got four fucking dogs, but I love dogs here." And then listen to the people that don't have any canine units, right? "Nah, we don't got a fucking dog. We never get a fucking dog. He's not going to do a fucking dog here," mm-hmm. right? And I'm not talking about the pros and the cons of the dog. To be honest with you, it's a overall pro. The amount of, it's so funny because these fucking dumb fucks in charge sometimes are like, "We don't want a dog biting somebody," and then dealing with a lawsuit. But statistically, it's proven that a dog, when it comes to a scene, makes people submit significantly faster and reduces the likelihood of physical confrontation because the dog is there as that threat of, if you don't comply, this thing's going to chew your ass off. And it's funny. These guys are like, "Ah, we don't want a lawsuit." You're going to get more lawsuits not having the dog. "Oh, dogs are expensive." Right. And so you get your dog hooked up with an organization that actually goes out and seizes money. And then the dogs become very fruitful. I know organizations that have canine units that bring in $400,000, $600,000, $700,000 a year in seized money back because some other organization that takes down big organizations like DEA or something like that will need a canine to come. They don't have dogs, the DEA. They use local dogs. Once they link up with a guy or a girl, a couple they like, they bring you along. These guys hit millions of dollars all the time.
Sure.
And now this dog's bringing in 10, 20% of that. I always think about Robert Kiyosaki. You know who that is? He wrote a book called Rich Dad, Poor Dad.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I didn't know the name, but I know the book, yeah.
One of his books, he talked about the importance of a businessman being the president of the United States. And I'm not talking, and this is before Trump was elected, but I understand what he means by that. You just can't make anybody, especially somebody who's not good at business, to be in charge of the world's biggest business. You can't do that. And that's what happens in law enforcement. You've got people who just aren't good at business. If you're good at business, you should run an organization. But if you're not, and you're really bad at business, this is where the problems lie. Because I can prove to you all these things to be true and disprove a lot of your myths or your concerns. "Oh, I heard from this guy that the dog's a nightmare." Well, that's his perspective of it. But when I talk to the other guy who has four or five or six, seven dogs, and they're the best things that they have. Yeah. So it's wild, man. You start understanding the concepts. And you know, we get these guys in the group who will put up, "My agency doesn't want a dog. I want to pitch to them. Anybody have any good pitches?" Literally the pitch is, it's not going to work. Your chief either wants a dog or he doesn't want a dog, or she doesn't want a dog. That's just the way it's going to be. They are sometimes, yeah, put it together on paper just to appease you, just to entertain you a little bit. But the people that are making these decisions, most of the time, or a lot of the time, aren't qualified to make the good decisions. And fortunately enough, sometimes they've actually submitted that they aren't, and leave it to the rank and file to make the decisions on their behalf. And that's good leadership, man. That's what it comes down to, right? That's good leadership. That's why leadership is so important. Compassion, empathy, being a good person. You ask yourself, I just talked to my friend before, he's a lieutenant. And I said, hey, when are you going to be a captain? He goes, oh, maybe in a few years. I said, do the people that work for you now think you're a good dude? He goes, I hope so. I go, and that's enough for me to believe that you really do believe that. Right? You didn't say, I don't care what they think. I have a job to do. They don't like. I've heard that before. The things that we do are unfavorable often. People don't understand what we go through as a captain or a lieutenant. You don't understand. Some things we got to do up here are unfavorable. Maybe so, but with an explanation, people would understand it. Hey, guys, listen, this is why we can't get the fucking these. This is the why, da-da-da. Like, we tried. We heard you. We validated you. We're working on it. It's very different than, like, we're not doing it, okay? Just is what it is. Yeah. I know what you guys want. We're just not doing it. I don't give a fuck. Two different forms of leadership. You have people are misinterpreting the message here, and I don't want that to happen anymore. Try to understand what we're trying to say. Overall, if you would like to see things get better, you must ask yourself a question. Are you contributing to the better good or the latter? That's what I'm saying. Who are you in this role, from patrolman up to chief to colonel, whoever it may be, to politician? You're complaining so much. You don't like things you see on Fox News and CNN. What are you doing to help it? That's all I need to know. And you don't have to do a lot.
Yeah, we make it too complicated. Think of how many supervisors that had to still make those hard decisions, those unpopular decisions. But he was the guy that took care of his guys, right? I would take those decisions much lighter. You know, if Captain so-and-so took care of his guys or gals, whatever, took care of his guys, then when the captain had to say, hey, you're fucking wrong, I'd go, all right, I must be wrong, you know, because he took care of his people. And whatever that means, equipment or individual status or whatever that is for somebody. I'm no leadership expert, but if you're the lieutenant, like you said, of your buddy that takes care of his people, when he does have to make a hard decision, it's still a hard decision. It still may be unpopular, but if you normally take care of us, we tend to go, oh, well, yeah, it makes sense. That sucks.
As trust, opposed to, you build that trust. Guy,
he doesn't care about us. It's horrible, you know?
You've built trust. You build trust. You know, this person is not selfish. And if they do something that's uncomfortable or doesn't seem like it was something we'd appreciate, we would say, well, his hands are probably tied in this one because he's been so good to us, or she's been so good to us every other time. There's a trust level.
Right, right.
Dude, listen, I do my best. I'm a work in progress. I am a student for life, and I do my best to try to show up and create an example. I try to remind everybody, folks, I'm a fucking human being, right? I'm a human being trying to do some big shit, and mistakes are going to be made. There's nothing I can do about that except do the best I can to try to mitigate or reduce the likelihood of mistakes being made. But it happens. It happens here, dude, but I try to always show up and do the right thing, always. And people have to try to understand that, and I think people really give me the pass on that. So anyway, let's fucking wrap, dude. Let's call it a day. Listen, Dr. Trevor Wilkins, this will not be the last time you see the angry, bearded, fucking Viking, psychopath, hatchet-wielding therapist.
I can't get better than that.
Yeah, weightlifting, ginormous human being with traps that look like the Rocky fucking mountains. But listen, dude, it's always a pleasure, man. I'm glad you came on again, and I'm glad that we have a friendship, and I always enjoy hearing from you, honestly.
Agreed. Same here.
All right, man. Without further ado, we are out. Peace. Guys, if you're in an area where you're trying to get to our classes, but we're not close to you, fret not. We actually have on-demand training at streetcop.com. You can take that course online right now, and then you could attend that training in the future at no additional cost. You can redeem your voucher, so you get two for the price of one. We don't want to deny you the ability to take this training now, especially knowing that it can keep you safe, at a very minimum, putting bad guys in jail where they belong, and at the maximum, going home to your family. Check out streetcop.com for that offer.